coming straight from the heart. This is bbsradio.com, and we hope to make your listening time a pleasant one. We are bringing you a lot of new shows. One of those new shows that we're bringing on board is the Robin Quayle Show. Here to debut the Robin Quayle is Robin Quayle.
Hello. Well, my name is Robin Andrews Quayle, and for the last 30-some-odd years, I've been a regressive hypnotherapist and a paranormal counselor and UFO counselor and a few other things. But I'll give you a brief, I'm having to sort of start over here, brief background. I've been in metaphysical studies. I was 10 years old, and my mother had a healing from a spiritual healer, and she started sort of reading and teaching me the things that she was studying, and I had a few sort of paranormal experiences growing up. And then in the 60s, I was studying some New Thought systems and of healing, and I was in a deep spiritual study when I suddenly got a phone call one day that my father had died. Well, I hung up the phone quickly, and in fact, a neighbor of my mother's called and said, "We think your father's dead," and they went to another city, and I said, "Oh, no," and I just hung up the phone. I couldn't explain why I did that, and I ran to my room, and I bolted the door, and my brother was fisting with his wife from another city, and my husband was there, and my children were there, and so I was shaking so badly in this room, and I remember the thought coming to me, "You better make this spiritual stuff work for you now, or you're going to be in deep trouble," because I was shaking so hard. My teeth were clacking together loudly, and I couldn't think, so I was just holding to one thought that had come through my study was, "There is no death. There is no death," and over, I was repeating that in my mind frantically. Suddenly, I was catapulted out of my body into the light. It was just totally unexpected, and I was like with my father, and there were some other presences there too, and it was the most indescribably beautiful, exquisite kind of experience I could even describe. I can't describe it. It is indescribable, and most of the people, if you've heard of near-death experiences, which is exactly what happened to me. I had a shared near-death experience with my father. I went to the light with him. And, of course, at that time, I had never even heard of a near-death experience, much less a shared one. So, finally, I was aware of being back in my body and back in the room. And I went out then, and I told my family that my father had passed, and I was in utter joy. I was in utter peace. I was still in this exquisite, peaceful, joyful state of enlightenment, and I felt like I was glowing for many, many yards around me. I felt like there was this huge glow around me, and I went through a whole week of this, went through funeral arrangements, funeral, everything. And I was actually embarrassed by this because I thought people will think I don't care. But it was, as I recall now, looking back on it, this was in the 60s, that this was the most joyous week I ever remember spending in my entire life. It was like I was walking on clouds the entire week. And I was totally healed of grief. And then 9 years to the day after that, my mother died. And then 2 months after that, my oldest son was killed in a hang gliding accident. Well, I didn't have that kind of experience all over again, but I did have this deep peace, and the sense of loss and grief was gone. I was able to be calm and serene and know that there is no death. And some years later, I also lost a second son in an ultralight experience. And again, that carried me through. I think this prepared me. I don't think if I'd ever had this experience, I could have ever lived through losing those two boys that way. I had five children, and these were my two oldest boys. So anyway, some years later, I was divorced and moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and was able to meet and become very good friends with Dr. Raymond Moody, who pioneered the near-death movement in 1975. He wrote the book called Life After Life, which became an international bestseller, and was the first book that, you know, in our time that was ever written about near-death experiences. And Raymond had had an experience in at the University of Virginia, where he was getting a doctorate in philosophy. And so he met Dr. George Ritchie, who later wrote some books about his own near-death experience, and he heard of Dr. Ritchie's experience. And so then when Raymond got his doctorate in philosophy and taught for a while, and then went back to medical school in Georgia. And so during his time in medical school, he was able to encounter many patients who were being resuscitated from heart attacks and so forth. And so he began to interview these people, and I think he interviewed 150 people that had had near-death experiences. And many of them had had these remarkable experiences of feeling like they were going through a light tunnel, and they were in this exquisite place, and they had utter joy and indescribable, exquisite feelings like I did. Most of them said that they did not want to return. Some were told that they had to return. Some were told that they needed to return. Some were told that loved ones here needed them, or sometimes they would think of a loved one here, and that would sort of draw them back. But anyway, he wrote this book actually rather naively, just sort of like a little exercise that he wrote, having no idea the import that this book would have, because I think that it actually made a paradigm shift. I think it changed the way we think about death in this country. I think it gave a huge number of people the confidence that there is a life after death. The average person grows up being taught this and believing this, but this gave them a knowing about this that was different. And I think it gave many people that peace. So anyway, I got to work a number of years with Dr. Raymond Moody. We did some teaching together. We were both board members of a parapsychology institute at West Georgia College, and helped put on many conferences and classes. And later we were invited to go to Russia give some of our experiences over there. And that brings me to the main case that I wanted to talk about. Was a very interesting case of a man who had, at that time, who originally is from Soviet Georgia. He was from Tbilisi, Georgia. And he was born in the Gulag. His parents were political prisoners. His mother was a physician. His father was an engineer, I believe. And the family had been in Georgia for several centuries. I think they were originally British, but they had this child, and then they were brought back to Moscow. And so they knew that they were probably going to be killed. So they gave this young child, actually still a baby, to friends of theirs in Tbilisi, who desperately wanted a child and they knew would love him. And they were killed. They were interrogated and then shot. And so he grew up in a very loving family that had a wonderful library and very educated. And so, but he began to read the classics and he got a very good education. his family had died. His parents had died by the time he was 14. So by then he had begun to question a lot of things in the state, and he had begun writing dissident poems. So some of these were being published in little underground newspapers. So he was being sort of targeted as a dissident, politically incorrect kind of person in that time. So they came and put him out of the house and boarded up the house, the state did, and wouldn't let him live in his own house now that he had inherited. So he had to live around with friends for a while, for a couple of years. Finally got back in the house, went to the universities, got a very fine degree. I mean, got many degrees, very fine education, and began to teach at the university there in Tbilisi. So he was still a dissident. So by this time, they had heard about him in other countries and for his writings, and so Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter had invited him to come and speak in this country. Well, now this is before 1989, and so the curtain is not down yet in the Soviet Union, and so he... It was a question about whether he was going to be allowed to come, but he finally got the papers. They really couldn't sort of ignore such a high-level invitation, so they gave him the papers. But then, as he's waiting for a cab, Brenda's trying to flag the cab, and he's standing with his suitcases back in some trees. A small car comes up over the curb, goes through the trees, runs over him, circles around and runs over him again. Now it gets suspicious. So then he's taken to the hospital where they examine him and pronounce him to be dead. So he's put in a morgue refrigerator on a Friday afternoon. His family was waiting at the airport to see him off. So it's decided that they will do an autopsy on him to say that he has indeed died of an accident. So on Monday, this is now 3 days later, they take him out of the morgue and start. His own uncle, who was a physician, was present at this autopsy. There was a large hematoma in his belly, so they started to cut this open, and his eyes popped open. And the doctor just calmly reaches up and closes the eyes, and a minute later they pop open again, and he does the same thing, and then a minute later they pop open again. Well, this time the doctor notices that the pupils contracted, and he screams, "There's life here," and they rush him into the hospital. George told me later that he was not breathing at this time. He said only my eyes and ears and brain were working. So they rush him into the hospital. Now, here's a country that has tried so hard to kill him. They had to run over him twice so he couldn't come to this country and speak about what was going on over there. And now they go to extraordinary measures to keep him alive. And for 6 hours, they worked on him and even opened him up and massaged inner organs, and all sorts of unusual things were done, he said. So finally they got him stable, and he's in the hospital for 6 months. Now this man has had really a mother of all near-death experiences next to Jesus Christ, and we wonder what could have happened during those 3 days that he was essentially out of body and on the other side, so to speak. So most people, I'm sure, have heard about others or read of near-death experiences and know the typical case where someone goes through a light tunnel and goes into this exquisite place of light where they're often loved ones there to greet him, or angelic-looking beings or beings of light or presences or a really wonderful, loving place. So he's in a very dark place at first, totally dark, and he's not knowing what to do, and he's looking around in the darkness, and he can see nothing but complete and utter darkness. But then he sees a tiny speck of light, and it begins to grow and grow and gets bigger and bigger. And finally, he's in this fullness of light, and there are spiritual beings there to greet him and to talk to him. And one in particular that he described was a lady. And so one of the first things that he saw was his grave, where his wife had already had the grave dug. And in the custom there was to dig a double grave so that when the wife died, she could be buried there with him. So she had been thinking in her head, but I'm so young, I may want to get married again. I'm not sure I want to be buried here. So after he's stable again, he's telling his wife, who has been raised totally as an atheist, what she was thinking. So it frightens her. It takes her years to get over this terror that he brings out in her about talking about these experiences on the other side. So there were some other experiences that he had during that time. I'll mention a few of them. One was that there was a baby, an infant that some friends of theirs had this child that wouldn't stop crying. And for days, the child's been crying and crying in great pain. The doctors couldn't discover what was wrong. So he communicates with this child. And so after he's awake again, he tells the doctors that it's the collarbone, right collarbone, I think it was. And sure enough, this is what was wrong with the baby. Another really unusual and interesting thing that he had that was quite different from any I had heard was that he communicated with dolphins. And somehow these dolphins we know are incredibly great intelligence on this planet. And somehow they were able to show him that there was this small shark that lived there in the Black Sea near Tbilisi. And that this shark is about 3 feet long, generally, and it swims near the bottom where the magnetic forces are strong, which may have something to do with the healing properties that they are able to give, because the dolphin were able to show him that the liver of this shark could be used to cure cancer. So after he is out of the hospital later, he is able to start a clinic. And this clinic, he is also a psychiatrist, was curing people of cancer. And what they would do, they would take half of the liver of the shark, and then the shark would be sewn back up and put back alive in the sea where the liver would regenerate it. And then this liver was processed or centrifuged and injected, the fresh liver, into the patient with cancer. And very successfully it was curing cancer. It's sort of I think with the live shark, there was some kind of resonance going on here, sort of like a homeopathic vibrational essence occurring that may have had something to do with the healing. And then the shark would regenerate the liver. So they took children from the Chernobyl incident and who had been sent home to die, who were bald-headed and were dying of cancer, were sent home to die, and they took these children and treated them. And he said in 3 months, they were out riding their bikes, their hairs had grown back, and they were healthy again. They took them back to the hospital, and the doctor, where they had been discharged, accused them of substituting other children. So when they proved these were indeed the same children, the doctor of this hospital, the director of this hospital, quit his job and came to work in the clinic with them. So then, as usually the case, when you're this successful with cancer treatments, the authorities don't like this, and so the KGB came and shut them down, and so they had this big trial, and thousands of people poured into the airport and the train station to testify. and attend these trials, and it was proven the efficacy of this treatment without question, and so they had to let them open back up. And he said at the time that he finally left the Soviet Union that the Japanese were pouring over there to get treatments. But anyway, he has now seen that God is real, that there is a God. He believes now. He had a lot of question about this before, even though the state and the schools and everything were teaching atheism. He had been reading the philosophers, been reading everything, so he had a lot of questions about that. So now he knows. He's been there. He knows there is a God. He knows there is no death. So he becomes a priest in the Georgian Orthodox Church, which he says was distinctly different from the Russian Orthodox Church. Anyway, then later he becomes an archpriest, and he's doing quite well. He's over about 25 churches in that area, and he's well-paid and living quite a good life, but he's still a dissident now. So he's on television one night, and he tells how the KGB is using orphan children for medical experiments. So that night, some quote-unquote thugs came to the house and beat him up and shot him in the head, and he had another near-death experience, not quite as dramatic as the first, but he survived this one. But then he knows he has to get out of this country. He had met a lady at a concert who was a Methodist minister who was over there with her son, and so he contacts her, and through her and Kissinger and Carter and the embassies and the Methodist Church and so forth, he is able to come to this country. The Methodist Church decided to recognize his ordination and give him a job as a minister in a little small country church outside Houston, near Houston. So they're able to come to this country where they feel safer. His wife does not speak any English at all. He speaks many languages. And so his wife is very unhappy at first, even though she's a biochemist, very educated woman, very smart. It took her a number of years, and she's still quite frightened of him because of the near-death experience, did not even want him to touch her. So I met him soon after he came to this country, and he was trying to find a place where he could get really a better job because he wasn't making very much money there. So I invited him to speak at a conference we were giving at our West Georgia College, where I introduced him to Dr. Raymond Moody, and where he met Daniel Brinkley and Dr. William Rowe and some of the others that were working with us. And so he was able to do some documentaries and things like that. Subsequently, just several years ago, the Discovery Channel did a special on his life and actually went to Tbilisi and interviewed doctors and hospitals and documented every bit of this story, which is quite unbelievable, really, to hear. And so I was helping introduce him to people and helping him trying to help him get a job at a university here. When the curtain's down and everything, he's invited to come to Moscow and speak at a dissidents conference. Here again is the irony of this country. So then, later that year, I think it was about 95, Dr. Raymond Moody, Daniel Brinkley, who was another near-death survivor, George Radonaya, and I were all invited to come and do some lectures, do some television documentaries, interviews, and all kind of things for about 10 days in Moscow. We were the guests of this country. We were, I think, several institutes sponsored it, but they paid for everything. They paid for our entire trip and just treated us royally. And I just want to tell you an interesting little side story about this. George had to go back early because Easter's Easter was earlier over here than it was over there, and his church was having Easter, so he had to come back a few days before the rest of us were coming back. So a little misunderstanding had happened the last day about some of the money situation I'd done, and I won't go into that, but George was a little embarrassed. And so when I got back, I got a call right away from a friend of mine who had met George at my house at a party I'd had for him some years before when he was speaking here in town. And this friend said, "You've got to come over here because George was in my room this morning." He said he was shaking me by the shoulders. And, of course, he was speaking about his astral body form, but he could clearly see him. Now, this man had had a near-death experience himself, so this may account for some of the reason why he could see him so clearly and all. But he said George was telling me, he said, listen, Robin's got to forgive me. Well, I wasn't mad at George, but I was trying to get him a job here, and he knew that. So he said, I was just pulled into his head, and there I saw scenes of his childhood. I saw scenes of y'all's trip in Russia, and said, he was telling me, he said, I couldn't go over there. Here he'd been living quite a high lifestyle over there. He said, we were making about $8,000 a month, would be in American money. And over here he was making about $250 as a poor little country preacher. And so he said, I just couldn't go over there and not look successful. So we had sort of been amused because George had been acting a little bit like a big shot when we got over. He actually got over there before we did. And so we were teasing him a little bit about that, but it was not a big thing. So anyway, he said, I was just seeing all these things that were happening with y'all, and I was just like in George's head. And said, then George says to me, I tried to get in Robin's house, but there was a white dome over her house, and I couldn't get through it. So I just kept making a spiral until I found someone that I knew. And, of course, this young man had lived not too far from me, and he found him. So, and this person did not know anything about what had been happening with us in Russia, and all, so I thought it was quite remarkable that there was George able to not only communicate with him, but to able to actually touch him, and for him to be able to see George fully materialized there. So it was a remarkable experience. But the real interesting thing was that I was so glad that the protective dome of light that I put over my house every day was actually working and keeping people from intruding, even if it was a friend. So anyway, one thing I wanted to say about George was that he had always believed, he'd been told that his parents had been murdered, but he was wondering if they just abandoned him. And he'd always wondered that. And then during his near-death experience, he was actually able to see what happened to them. They were actually interrogated, shot in the back of the head, and he said their bodies were dissolved in acid by the KGB. So even though that was a terrible thing for him to witness, it gave him a peace to know that they did indeed love him and it had not abandoned him. So I think I have enough time. I want to tell you about another near-death case that I thought was remarkable. This man's name is Mellon Thomas Benedict, and he was an artist who found out some years back that he had an inoperable cancer that had spread. And so he didn't want his parents to mortgage their home and go into debt and everything, and he thought it was pretty far gone anyway, and so he just didn't tell them how bad it was. But he finally went into hospice, And he had asked his hospice worker, he said, "Now when I go, I want to ask you if you will give me 6 hours alone, leave me in my room in my bed for 6 hours." And she said, "No, we can't do that, but I will give you 3 hours." And so the morning that he passed, he told everybody goodbye. He told them he knew that was the day. And so then sometime during that day, he was examined and declared to be dead. So she covered him up and she closed the door and left him alone as he had requested. So about an hour and a half later, she went in just to check on things, and he was not in the bed anymore. He was on the floor moving about, and she was quite alarmed and excited, and she called the doctors and everything, and they got him back in the bed, and they did a full examinations and scans and everything on him, and there was no cancer. He was completely healed. And so he just smiled at the doctor, and he said, "Well, Doc, I guess it's a miracle, huh?" And the doc, he said, was very disturbed and said, oh no, it's spontaneous remission," and just ran out of the room and was just really frightened by the experience and never came back to see him, never came back in the room. So after this, Mellon Thomas was employed. He'd never had any medical training at all, but he was employed by Johns Hopkins University in their research labs. And after about 3 weeks, they said, "Look, you have done more in 3 weeks than some of our scientists have done in 7 years." But then later, he started his own research labs, and I believe that's what he's doing today. But every case has a different quality to it and a different experience that's so remarkable. I mentioned, I think, that Dr. Raymond Moody's first case that he ever heard about was Dr. George Ritchie, who was a professor at the University of Virginia when Raymond was still working on his philosophy degrees. And so he went to see, someone took him to see Dr. Ritchie, and he told him about his experience. And he was a young soldier in Camp Barclay, Texas, at the time, about 19 years old. So Raymond subsequently went to medical school later after he got a PhD in philosophy, taught for a while. Then he went back to medical school in Georgia, and he began to hear other cases of near-death experiences, and he began to record them until he had 150 cases, and he wrote this book called Life After Life, which is now a phenomenon. It's been an international bestseller for so many years. It was written in 1975, and it changed the way Americans think about death. I think it gave people that sense of knowing that there really is no death, that we can go to the other side, that we can see our loved ones, that there's no such thing as death. And there are many skeptics that have tried to refute the near-death experiences and refer it to the temporal lobe things, or it's this or it's that. But people have had too many remarkable experiences and too many validating experiences. I don't know that you can ever prove life after death, just like I don't know if you can ever prove reincarnation. But, you know, I've done about 30,000 regressions in my life, and I've had so many incredibly life-changing experiences with people that are so validating to them, that have healed them of phobias and all kinds of things that, you know, I can't doubt it, and they can't doubt it either. So you have to almost experience these things for yourself, I think, to really know it fully, to have that knowing about it. But Raymond's book was so convincing because every one of these cases were real-life people that each had a whole different healing about it, and it changed their lives. These near-death experiences totally changed their lives. And so I wanted to tell you about Dr. George Ritchie's experience. He was a young soldier at Camp Barkley, Texas, at 19, and he had just been told that the military was going to send him to medical school in Virginia. So he had had pneumonia, and he thought he had recovered. And so he was running through the streets, trying to get to the train so he could go to medical school. And he became delirious and passed out, and they took him to the hospital. So he was totally unconscious when he went to the hospital. And he was put in this room, and the doctors examined him and declared that he was dead. So he was covered up. And so after a while, there was a young orderly in the room who was about the same age as George, and he went to the doctor and begged and pleaded with him to please try again. And so finally, reluctantly, the doctor came back and tried again. No luck, and covered him up again. So after a few minutes, the young man begged again, please, 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 just try one more time. Please try to revive him. Well, this time, he did. He revived him. But on George's end, I think he was out for maybe 9 minutes of our time, and a lot can happen in that 9 minutes when you're on the other side. So his experience was that, again, he was racing through the streets trying to get to the train. And then he suddenly realizes he doesn't have his body with him. So he's frantic. He goes back to the hospital. And he doesn't even know what room he's in because he was unconscious when he came in there. So he's just passing through the walls, which you can do in your astral body quite easily. And he's going from room to room trying to find his body, and he finally sees this body that's covered up with a sheet, and there's a hand that looks, he said it looked like my dead grandfather's hand that's sticking out and has a ring on it, and it's his ring. And he is so frantic to see that body there, he lays down on top of the sheet, on top of the body, and is trying to wriggle down inside the body, and he can't get in. And so at this point, he said that the room just totally filled with light, and there was some kind of spiritual being or presence there. I think George, being a very fundamentally religious person, felt this was Jesus. And many people have felt that this, or felt other great spiritual beings or angels with him. But anyway, he was taken on sort of a tour on this plane. So one of the first things he was shown was several different suicides, one at a time, who were walking along behind their loved ones. Now, the suicides are, of course, in their astral body, their spiritual body, and the loved ones are walking along in the physical body, and the suicides are so distressed. They think, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I did not know how much I would hurt you. And they see that the problems that made them commit suicide still exist, but that they are and now do nothing about it because they don't have their body anymore. And so he saw the futility of that, and then he was taken to a bar, interesting thing, and he said that he saw it was like a raunchy waterfront bar where sailors were getting roaring drunk, and he had never been in that bar before. And he was watching. He said, I could tell the spirits, because they didn't have an aura. The live people had auras, but the spirits didn't. But they were desperate spirits. They were alcoholic spirits who were desperately grabbing for drinks, and their hands were going right through the glasses or right through whatever they reached it through. And so he said, maybe this is why they call it spirits, that we drink. But so anyway, one sailor stood up and just sort of drained his drink and then just passed out cold on the floor. And he said the instant he hit the floor, he saw that his aura peeled open and one of those spirits was in his body like a flash. Well, he saw this happen again while he was there. So he was seeing that, you know, getting out of control with alcohol or drugs or something like that makes you vulnerable to the spirits being able to attach. Now, I've done lots of spirit releasement work, and it's been my experience that most alcoholics or drug addicts have an attaching spirit that's also addicted. And I don't believe it's like a what we call possession totally. I think I call it attaching spirits. And Edith Fiore did a book about this called The Unquiet Dead, where she describes this process. But I think that these spirits can influence a person a great deal. They can urge you to get another drink, you know, let's just go by it. It won't hurt to just have one more. And urging and urging and urging. Because the spirit, as I understand, can taste the alcohol, can feel the inebriation or the high of the drug. Also, this is true of emotions. They can feel emotions. They can feel sex. They can taste food and whatever, as long as it's sort of melded with your aura. And then if you get a little out of control, like the person got drunk and passed out, or if you get really drunk or really wildly out of control with your emotions or anything else, and the spirit, I think, can push you out of the way for a little while and take control. And this is my answer for the blackout spells where people, you know, have these act out in these embarrassing ways and then later don't remember anything about it. I've seen people do this. And it's even by looking in the eyes, you can tell that, not there, there's somebody else there. So anyway, George had this experience of seeing that bar, and then he went into the light and had the higher level of spiritual experience that is more typical of seeing the light beings and loved ones and so forth. Well, I'm not going to dwell on that because there's a more interesting part of this story that I want to add. But so finally, when George got out of the hospital, a couple of weeks later, he was being driven somewhere in Louisiana, and he was in a neighborhood, and he wasn't driving, but he said suddenly to the person who was driving, "Stop the car, stop the car, turn here, turn here, turn here." And they pulled up in front of a bar, and he got out of the car and he ran in, and it was exactly the same bar he had seen in his near-death experience, but he had never been there. He had never been even in this town before. So I thought that was really a remarkable experience. But then, after the book came out, Raymond's father was a physician and pretty much a skeptic so far as these kind of things. They had a lot of arguments about this stuff, but Raymond's father was reading the book. He was down in Macon, Georgia, and was reading the book. And so his father reads this account of Dr. George Ritchie, and he says, "Dr. George Ritchie, Camp Barkley, Texas, 1943, I believe it was." Well, it just so happens that Raymond's mother and father were stationed there. He was a physician in the military, and he was stationed there at that exact time. And just about at that exact time, Raymond Moody was conceived. And then shortly after that, Raymond's mother and father moved away and moved back down to Georgia, down to Macon, Georgia. So years later, when Raymond's in college in Virginia, he meets with Dr. George Ritchie. So then, a few years ago, Raymond had told me that he wanted to move. He was living in Georgia at the time of West Georgia College, that he wanted to move to Alabama, and would I please help him find a house? So I went over there, and I had found an old, he said, it has to be an old house, and it has to have a front porch that I can have a rocking chair on, because that's where Raymond writes. He sits in a rocking chair, and he writes his books in longhand on a long legal pad. He has computers and all, but I don't think yet Raymond knows how to use them. But anyway, so he said, it just has a front porch I can put a rocker on. So I found this house, and I took Raymond to see it, and he said, yeah, let's go get it. It's outside of Anniston, Alabama. was out in the country, and he said, yeah, I like it. Let's go buy it. So I said, well, let's look some more. Let's don't be that hasty. Let's look around a little bit more. And he said, no, it's okay. Let's just go get it. So as we're leaving this neighborhood, which is a small community, where there'd been a lot of French settlers there, we pull up, we go over an old covered bridge, and we pull up in front of an old mill, right on the mill pond in the creek. Just a beautiful, idyllic setting. And we pulled up in front of this and just looked at it and said, swooned, sort of. And Raymond said, oh, my God, I could never afford anything like this. And I said, well, I don't know. Why don't you just let's see what we can find out. It wasn't for sale. So we found the lady's name, and we called her, and we said, could we come look at this house? So she's showing us around very graciously. She and her husband was a retired Navy captain, were showing us around. So after a few minutes, she turns and she says, what do you do? And I said, well, this is Dr. Raymond Moody. I don't think she caught his name in initial introductions. And she says, oh, Dr. Moody. She said, do you know that Dr. Ritchie used to live here and that we had a group in this house studying near-death experiences and similar things, and this group still meets here? And I thought, oh, my God, here's Dr. Ritchie again, all intertwined in Raymond's life this way, bringing him. And the mill has been, subsequently, we did buy it after 6 months. It was negotiations and talking them into selling it, and now it's just this beautiful place. He's been on television many times with it, and it's just, it's beautiful. So then I had invited Dr. Ritchie to come speak at one of our conferences, and he got sick and couldn't make it. But then I finally got to meet him, because he came to Raymond's wedding, which was at the mill in a beautiful big gazebo down by the water. So it was just a it's just so interesting how these synchronistic experiences are interwoven in our lives. Now, I'm sure that if we did regressions on both of them or something, we would probably find many past life connections, and that they had made some kind of perhaps an agreement to come in and do something together, because clearly Dr. Ritchie's narrative, the first one that Raymond ever heard about a near-death experience, sparked that curiosity in Raymond's mind to begin to document that experiences, and that book made a paradigm shift. I have no doubt about it. In this country and many other countries, when we went to Russia, Raymond gave a lecture at the University of Virginia. Well, there were about the University of Moscow. There were about 1,000 people there, and I've arranged and also been to many, many of Raymond's lectures. No, I've never seen, he always has a big crowd, but never that many people. Anyway, Raymond modestly says, how many people have read Life After Life? I promise you that over half of the people in that room raised their hands. Now, bear in mind, this is a country that has only recently seen the curtain come down, and they are now able to read books like this. They told us that before the curtain, a book like this would have been verboten. You could have been imprisoned for reading it. And they said, we had long, long lists, waiting lists to read this book, and they were passed around from person to person. And even under those conditions, when there are not that many copies available and people had to wait long weeks before they could read it, half of those people had read that book. Half of those people were thirsty enough for that kind of knowledge and that kind of spiritual growth that they had read it. So certainly it has had an effect on them. And I think it's had a very far-reaching effect, and I've seen it many times at conferences. I've seen people talk about how and their emotions and all, when they talk about how, because when many people had these near-death experiences, they didn't understand it. Many of them thought they were crazy, and they didn't have any understanding of what had happened until they met Raymond or read his books and had some explanation that other people had been through these things. So now that, you know, resuscitation in hospitals from cardiac arrest and heart attacks and so forth is so much easier and happens so much more often, we have many, many more of these. So many millions of people have had these experiences. Not everybody that has a near-death experience goes through these kind of experiences. Either they don't remember it, I don't know which. Perhaps sometimes if people are in comas for a long time or something, the memory is buried. I don't know. But, you know, I think that sometimes in these coma cases, I've tried to collect cases of people who've been in non-responsive comas where they've said they're flatlining and so forth, who've recovered and been all right. And I met a man who told me that he had been in a coma for months, and that at times he was flatlining like that. They didn't think he was risking. They thought he was going to die at one point, so they called in a priest to give him the last rites. And so then later, finally, some weeks later, he did come out of the coma, and he was okay. So they called this priest back, and the priest was in his room and was laying out all this communion implements. And he said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to give you Holy Communion." And he said, "I'm not Catholic." And he said, "Well, when I came to give you the last rites," he said, "in the middle of the rites, you sat up and started to speak in perfect Caesarean Latin." He said, "I was going to ask you where you studied for the priesthood." And so obviously there was one of two things. Either this man was having a past life recall during the middle of his coma, somehow the near-death, last rites had triggered something, or another spirit had taken charge there for a little while. I don't know. It looks like I'm about to run out of time here. Enjoyed it very much, and I'll see you next Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.